Right now, her hands are all over me, and mine on her. And with any other girl, it'd be time to bring out the condom. But with Alex, I don't even consider reaching for my wallet. Instead, I pull back to put some space between us, because I'm not exactly thinking with my heart right now, and my dick is trying to undo my zipper from the inside. Another girl might ask me what's wrong, a little bit of a whimper in her voice, like she hasn't lived up to something I expected. Instead of that, I get Alex's palm, flat against my bare chest, an unspoken question in the amount of pressure she exerts. "Need a minute," I tell her. "Honestly, I need about a year and 6 feet of bricks in between us to keep myself under control, but I go for the next best thing." "I think you should meet my parents." She laughs again, this one coming out in kind of a snort that might embarrass other girls, but not Alex. "Why is that funny?" I ask her.
"It's not a situation I ever imagined myself in," she says, her own breath still coming a little heavy.
There's a naked bulb at the top of the staircase, and enough light reaches us that I can see her breasts going up and down, the ridge of her bra pressing against them.
"Well, imagine it," I say, pulling my eyes back up to her face, which is flushed and happy.
I made it that way, and that's enough to keep my gaze from wandering.
"Okay. When?"
"There's a home game next week. Maybe after that?" She nods, her cheek going up and down on my chest. And that little bit of friction gets me riled again. That, and the fact that 6 months ago, if you would have told me that a girl agreeing to meet my parents would give me a boner from hell, I would have punched you in the face. But if Alex is willing to do that, Alex, who still pieces together her sentences very carefully, even when we're alone, it means she's taking this as seriously as I am. And that's fucking hot. Once I asked my dad how you know when you're in love. He said you just know, and if you have to ask the question, then you haven't been in love yet. And he's right, because there aren't words for this. No combination of letters could ever represent what she is to me. But the flip side is that now I worry about losing her. I worry that I'm going to screw it up, that the Jack who was in the woods the night they found Anna's body is going to reassert himself. That guy was nowhere near classy enough to be with Alex. She is refining me every day, changing me from the person I was into someone better. And I need to be good enough, because I'm Alex Kraft's boyfriend. Chapter 33, Jack. Having Alex in my shitty truck doesn't make me feel good. When we run, we're on the same level. When we end up at parties together, we know we're going to find our own corner eventually. We expect to hear from each other every night, each of us checking our phones to see if we miss that moment somehow. But a real date hasn't happened yet, and there's a reason for that. I can't afford Alex Kraft. Hell, I can't afford any girlfriend, but there's an unspoken agreement that Branley pays my way wherever we go, and I've always managed to string other girls along until I'm bored with them as a hookup and cut them loose. With Alex, it's different, because I want to take her out on a real date, and my big mouth made that happen before my wallet filled me in on how skinny it is. The truth is, we're in my busted-ass truck, and she somehow blends in completely, yet looks like $1 million at the same time, and we're headed toward a burger joint because it's either that or a sit-down place the next town over, and I don't have enough gas to get us there. And after we've plowed through our $5 burger plates, I'm going to have to ask her to pay for it, because I am a fucking loser, and she'd be flat out within her rights to call me that. So that's what I'm thinking about as I pull into the restaurant on our first real date. What a fucking loser I am. We walk into the place and my mood drops even further because Brian Spurlaney yells my name from the back kitchen when he spots us. 3 years ago, Brian was everything I wanted to be. He was a senior when I came in as a freshman. Football, two-a-days, kicking my ass in 90-degree weather. We'd lose 5 pounds in the morning, put it back on when we went home to eat lunch, then lose another 7 in the evening. We smelled like ass sweat, and our faces were permanently broken out, but Brian kept our heads on straight,
putting out fires before fights broke out, telling the guys who were about to pass out that they could make it 5 more steps, and then the 5 more after that. Brian is truly a good guy. That's why it kills me a little bit when he comes out of the kitchen to talk to us while we eat and he's wearing a hairnet. "Hey, man," he says, flipping a chair around backward to sit at the end of our table. "What's up?"
"Just out grabbing something to eat," I say.
"Brian, this is Alex."
"Hi," Alex says, and he looks her up and down.
"Alex Kraft? I knew your sister. What happened to her was bullshit."
Alex smiles. "Possibly the best description I've heard." And while she doesn't seem to care that it came up, I hate that Anna is the first thing everybody thinks of when they see Alex, whether it comes out of their mouth or not.
Like when people run into me and all they want to talk about is the winning streak of whatever sports season it is, like I'm destined to be only a stat record in their head. Always winning, but never moving on. Stuck in this town forever and hauled out in 20 years to hand off a basketball or a football to the kid who breaks my school record, and then that's it. I'm done. Washed up. I'll be like Brian, who is sitting here smiling at me, his pores full of grill grease.
"Didn't you go to Fairmont to play ball?" I ask, and his smile falters a little.
"More like went to Fairmont to ride the bench," he says. "That and play tackle, dummy. Tore my ACL when some big asshole hit me, and that was it. Came home over Christmas break and got Tammy pregnant, so..." He holds his hands up like he was totally innocent of any involvement. "So that was that." I put down my burger. Would I have eaten a lead ball in my stomach as I think of all the times Branley was in too much of a hurry and I was too horny to bother with a condom?
"But I'm going back," Brian says, his tone too hopeful, like the way you sound when you talk about your dreams, not your actual plans. "Once little Becca gets into kindergarten, we won't have to pay for daycare, and that money can go to Daddy getting his degree."
"Yeah, man, cool," I say. But I know as well as he does that money is going toward putting in a second bathroom or paying for the next baby.
"So," Brian's eyes wander to Alex, "I heard somebody fucked up Ray Parsons' face. That was you, right?"
Alex takes a sip of her drink.
"Yep."
"Right on," Brian says, and fist bumps her. "Ray used to be a decent guy, but, you know..."
He lays his finger on one side of his nose. "I get it. Decent guys backslide into meth and gang rape. Good guys knock up their girlfriends and flip burgers." We get up to leave, my tray still half full because all I can think about is vomiting. Brian refuses to let us pay for our food, so that solves my money problem, but doesn't leave me feeling any less of a loser.
"Hey, man." Brian snags my arm at the door as Alex goes ahead. "Just so you know, Ray ain't exactly happy about everyone knowing a chick kicked his ass."
I watch Alex pop open the passenger door of my truck. She has to wrench it a little because it tends to stick.
"Alex can take care of herself," I tell him. "That's for damn sure. But maybe don't go driving down Central unless you have to. Hear me? Ray's mom lives there, and since you kicked them out of the church, Ray and his guys have been holing up there. I don't know. Just be careful. Can't ever tell what a tweaker's gonna do."
Truth. We hug awkwardly before I leave, the smell of hamburger grease sticking to me as I get behind the wheel.
"What was that about?"
Alex asks as I pull away. I should have known I couldn't play it cool with her, act like running into Brian was a casual thing, not a terrifying flash forward of what my life is going to be if I don't get the fuck out of here and never come back. And while Alex might know me well enough to get it, starting the conversation means telling her about how I've convinced myself that I can earn it by being a good guy, that getting out and staying out is how karma is going to reward me for not hitting the next joint and turning down every drunk girl who crawls into my lap at a party. And maybe it'll sound crazy to her that every decision I make, every day, is a choice between right and wrong with my future in the balance.
Jack?
I don't know how to say these things to her, so I go for the simple version. You know how the first day of English class, Miss Hendricks had us write an essay on how we define success? Alex nods.
What did you write? I ask her.
What was expected? What did you write?
One line. Getting out of this shithole. She gave me an A.
Oh, Jack Fisher, Alex sighs, a teasing smile on her face. Must be hard when everyone loves you.
I have to laugh at that. Me feeling sorry for myself, with my brain and my looks and my talent. I reach over to put my hand on her knee and she takes it, our fingers entwining as I drive out of town. On Central, because fuck Ray Parsons.
Define success, I say almost to myself. I didn't kill anyone today, Alex says.
I laugh again. A plus, babe.
And I think I could probably tell this girl anything, and she would understand.
Chapter 34. Alex. I'm trying very hard to be normal. This is not easy for me. Jack helps. Claire helps. When I'm with them, I can manage myself a little better, filter my environment so that the little things slide off my new, shiny facade. But some things penetrate, and when that happens, I go places I know they can't follow. We are in the gym. It's negative 15 outside, and so many of the buses wouldn't start this morning that they put those of us who drive in the gym for now, like a holding pen until the rest of the flock gets here. There aren't enough people for me to fade away, but too many for me to ignore them all. I don't know what to do with myself, even though Claire is beside me, chatting about something to her friend Sarah. Sarah doesn't like me, and that is fine. It's in the way she watches me from the side, like she doesn't quite trust me. After seeing me rip Ray Parsons' nose and part of his ear off his head, that might be a smart decision on her part. Jesus, Sarah says as Branley walks past us. Too cold to show off cleavage, so instead she goes for jeans so tight I can see her thong. She looks nice, I say, and she does. Branley always looks put together in a way that tells me she spends hours in front of a mirror before going outside. And while I don't understand that, I can respect it. Sarah looks at Claire like she's waiting for her to jump in, but Claire only shrugs. Whatever, she says, which earns me a dark look from Sarah that I don't understand. So, you're 30 points from the school record, right? Claire says, and Sarah's face lightens a little bit. They talk on about basketball, which switches over to a party last weekend, and then on to something else that I tune out, their combined voices a pleasant drone. I watch Claire for a moment. The minimal physical damage she took that night at the church has healed entirely. The emotional damage has left a scar, though, bumpy tissue somewhere deep inside her soul. It's like her naivete was excised, caution growing back in its place. It's a good thing. I watch her now, this girl who was so close to the unthinkable, now able to laugh and talk about inconsequential things. Part of me wants to ask her how she has done this, but another part of me already knows the answer. She started from a better place than me. Claire's baseline is closer to normal than mine, her beginning a smooth plane, while my life has always been peaks and valleys. Sarah has taken me to a valley right now. She knows I don't belong here. Something in her senses the wolf in me and would ban it. So I oblige her as much as possible, sinking down into one of the valleys. These are the places my friends can't follow, and I let Claire's voice fade away beside me. Out on the court, Jack is playing a pickup game. Even in jeans, he's fluid, his body doing exactly what he wants when he wants it to. I could watch him and find some reassurance, but behind him, something else is happening. There's a boy in the corner, humping a basketball and pretending to climax, his face going through a complex series of contortions. It's lewd in its accuracy, and I can't stand that I won't be able to get it out of my head now, what this stranger looks like in his most intimate moment. And I hate that he's going back to do it again, egged on by his friends, who seem to find some high cleverness in the fact that he's now behaving as if the basketball is performing oral sex on him. The teachers see him, I know it. Hendricks looks away and shakes her head. The others roll their eyes when she points it out, but no one stops him. His impropriety has thrown a wall of disgusting around him that no one wants to walk through, and so he keeps doing it. A few bleachers down, a group of freshmen notice and explode in a chorus of giggles. I don't think it's funny, but I can't tear my eyes away. I find myself memorizing his face, my brain cataloging his name when I hear it being tossed around by the girls below me. I shake my head to clear it, finally breaking my line of sight as he finishes. As if it's vital that he get to the end of his pretend sexual encounter with sports equipment. I wonder what would happen if I went down there, took a ball out of the cage, and pretended to have sex with it. I think people would stop and look. I think the whole gym would come to a standstill, and teachers would definitely interfere. There would be discussions, again, about what exactly is wrong with me that I would do such a thing. I would definitely log some more hours in the guidance office. But boys will be boys. Our favorite phrase that excuses so many things, while the only thing we have for the opposite gender is women, said with disdain and punctuated with an eye roll. The announcements come on, and let us know that all the buses have come in. We can go to class now, resume our daily lives. I'm going to try. I'm going to do my best to get that boy's face out of my head, to ban the distinct expression that signified his pleasure from my mind, so that I can open my locker, get my books, smile at Jack when he touches my elbow. I'm trying to be normal, but it is so very hard.
Chapter 35, Jack. There's a dead spot on our gym floor, a place where the padding underneath has fallen away from the wood. When a ball hits a dead spot, it doesn't bounce back right. Physics takes over, and talent can't fight science. You're thrown off. The millimeter of pushback you were expecting doesn't come, and from there, it's a domino effect. You lose control of your dribble. The fast break that looked so promising collapses into a turnover that makes you look like an asshole. Except that doesn't happen to my team, because we know exactly where the dead spot is. It's the definition of home court advantage, and we've needed every ounce of that tonight. I'm at the foul line, the entire gym a hurricane of sound as the fans on the visiting bleachers scream at me to fail, while the home side screams equally loud in support, all their words merging into a single wall of sound in which nothing is comprehensible. I glance at the clock, even though I know there are only a few seconds left. After I take this shot, there'll be only a tiny sliver of time for the other team to score, our path to the division title easily paved with a passage of one free throw, if I make it. My eyes slide off the scoreboard, and in all the waving signs of the bleachers, spinning noisemakers, and screaming people, I spot my Alex, still as a stone, both hands and fists on either side of her face and eyes locked on mine. Around her is chaos, the gym packed with everyone from the point guard's great-grandma to the local bar owner as the best team we've had in a decade closes the books on the regular season. Alex is silent and intense, the exact opposite of everyone around her, yet the only one who has my attention. We could be alone in this moment, and I know before the ball leaves my hands that it's good. I go straight for her at the buzzer, ignoring the fans who pour out of the bleachers, the pats on the back, the cheerleaders' fingernails sliding off my arms. All I want is Alex, and she stands still, waiting for me to come to her. Her skin soaks up my sweat as I hug her. My jersey is stuck to her as it is to me when we finally separate. People are still screaming all around me. Everyone's got their phones stuck in the air to capture the moment. Kids I don't even know cram their faces next to mine for selfies, and I'm stoked that we won and I made the shot that did it, but right now, my mind is somewhere else entirely. My hand in Alex's as I thread through the crowd, leading her over to my mom and dad. Alex, I say, pulling her in front of me, this is my mom and dad. Mom and dad, this is Alex. Hello, she says, nodding at both of them.
It's nice to meet you.
My mom goes in for a hug, which kind of makes me cringe, but Alex lets it happen, her hands stiffening in mine a little. But she doesn't drop-kick Mom either, so it's not a failure.
We're so glad to finally meet you,
my mom says, her hands still on Alex's shoulders. She actually takes a piece of Alex's hair and tucks it behind her ear, which I totally understand the urge to do because I've done it myself 100 times, but I shoot her a warning look anyway. My dad is smart enough to keep his distance, but he smiles at her. You're the girl, and I swear to God, if he says, with the dead sister, I will fall right through the dead spot in the floor. But instead, he finishes with, whose car we pulled out of the ditch, aren't you? Alex asks me, do you pull a lot of girls' cars out of ditches? I squeeze her hand. Nope.
Then yes, that was me, she tells Dad.
Well, it was worth the effort then, he says, and she gives him the biggest shit-eating grin I think I've ever seen on her adorable face.
You two have plans? Mom asks,
her own hand snaking through Dad's.
Or do you want to hang out with the old folks after the game?
And to be perfectly honest, I was kind of hoping I could park the car out on 27 for a bit before taking her home, but Alex tells Mom she'd love to come over. So I'm roped into at least 2 hours of euchre and 20 minutes of Mom showing Alex my baby pictures. And I'm actually kind of looking forward to it. I squeeze her hand as they walk away, the last few people emptying out of the gym. You did fine, I say. I told you not to worry. Just be yourself.
That is never good advice, she says, and I hug her again, because I just can't stop touching this girl.
Chapter 36, PK. I'm curled into a ball to conserve heat, my pajama pants-clad knees touching Alex's as our voices blend in the dark, pitched low and secretive so as not to wake my parents. Why is it called making out? She asks. This is the kind of thing Alex wonders about. Instead of talking about making out, she wants to know the origin of the phrase, and I'm totally going to grill her on exactly what she thinks constitutes making out in a minute. But it's actually a decent question. And like everything Alex says, it insists you stop and think about it. I don't know, I say, because you're definitely not making anything yet. And if it's hot and heavy, there's probably more in going on than out. She giggles a little, telling me that she knows exactly what I mean, and that means it's my turn to ask questions. I know Jack Fisher the same way he knows me. We grew up together, could identify each other's cars on the road, and even give a casual wave when we meet. But beyond that, I couldn't tell you if he's the kind of guy who's telling all the others about how far he gets with Alex, or if he keeps pussy talk on the down low. I don't know. And I don't know if Alex even understands that shit like that happens. That it's possible the feel of her nipples might be public knowledge now. Or that the sounds she makes when she's in the dark alone with him might get reenacted in locker rooms. Alex will mutilate people who slip things in my drinks. And I can't do that for her. But I can protect her in another way. Help her navigate the twisty paths of her first relationship, and try to stop her from getting played. Or at least buffer the blow when it happens. So, have you guys... No, she says, but doesn't offer anything else. I haven't either, I tell her. I was close, with Adam, but then we broke up. As much as I catch Park looking at you, I think you'll have another opportunity soon. Yeah, I tell her. We've been texting, but nothing's, you know, happened. Truth is, Adam's the only guy I've ever even kissed, so I'm not going to all-out bang Park the first time he tries anything. But it's not like I don't want to. Me either, Alex says. And it doesn't have anything to do with my sister, either. We're quiet for a second, letting that settle in before she goes on. Do you think you'll be okay with being touched after what happened at the church? I don't know, I say, and it's the truth. I haven't had a chance to find out yet. I've had a few nightmares. Ones that end with the tweakers getting what they wanted. I wake up rolled in my blankets as if they were a cocoon, layers of cotton protecting me from the real world. Sex seems so intense, Alex goes on. A lot of people are casual about it. Like putting part of someone else's body inside of your own isn't that big of a deal. I don't understand that. It's your genitals touching someone else's genitals. Only you would describe sex like that, I say. Well, that's what it is, she shoots back. Yeah, and now I, like, never ever want to do it. Yes, you do, she argues. And I do too. And there's nothing wrong with that. But it's not something that I'm going to do with Jack just because I'm his girlfriend and we're supposed to. So, in other words, you're not Branley Jacobs, I say, going for a joke that falls flat. I hear it not cover the distance between us, and I immediately wish I hadn't said it. You shouldn't be that way about her, Alex says. I hear what people say, and I bet half of it isn't even true. And even if it is, fine. She's no different from you and me. She wants to have sex. So let her. Easy to say when it's not your boyfriend she's having sex with. Was Adam your boyfriend when it happened, or had you already broken up? Technically, I don't know, and the burn has faded. My words lack the heat they used to, like I'm saying things out of habit and not because I actually feel that way anymore. I think of Branley that day on her doorstep, and how she's been a little nicer to me in the halls, saying hi sometimes when there's really no reason why she has to. I kind of don't think so. Me neither, Alex says. She likes boys and she can get them. You were hurt by that, but it wasn't Branley who hurt you. It was Adam. Fine, I say. But Branley and Jack used to hook up all the time, Alex. I mean, like, they cut their sexual teeth on each other's crotches and never really stopped, even when they were dating other people. So how would you feel if you found out Jack still had Branley on the side? I'd be pissed, she says, but not at Branley. She doesn't owe me anything. Would you, like, rip Jack's face off? She laughs, a loud one that she has to muffle with her hands. And part of me is a little bit shocked at that, and part of me revels in it. No, she says, like maybe she considered it for a second. But I'd definitely punch him in the dick. My turn to laugh. So hey, I say, finally finding a moment to talk about something that only she and I talk about. Remember that day I hit Branley? You only kind of hit Branley, Alex corrects me, and I give her a little shove in the dark. You know what I mean? Yeah, and I told you the difference between thinking about hurting someone and actually hurting someone is like fucking huge. Yeah, I interrupt. But here's something weird I've been thinking about. Oh boy, Alex says, and I shove her again. Shut up, I listen to all the weird shit you think about all the time. Alex makes a pfft sound in the dark. Okay, so here's the thing. I realized that, yeah, I think about violence sometimes, but I fantasize about apologizing, too. That's fucked up, Alex says, and she hardly ever swears. Explain. Like, if I see someone bullying somebody in the hall or whatever, it bothers me, and I'll think about it a lot, like, a lot, to the point where I replay it in my head and create the situation where I'm really nice to them and tell them that I'm sorry that happened or whatever, ask them to sit with us at lunch. Alex is quiet, like she's thinking, so I keep going. My mom and dad get all these Christian magazines, right? And when I was little, there were always pictures of kids in Africa with cleft palates on the back cover. And if you give $5 or whatever, they can fix this kid's face. There was this one girl who was a big mess, like her face was split in half. And I had this whole thing where I pretended I made mom and dad go to Africa and adopt her. She'd come home and live with me, and we'd fix her face, but also, she'd be my sister because I never had one, and I'd give her half my room and half my toys and half my clothes. And it was kind of screwed up, because that made me feel better, you know? Like me thinking about doing a good thing took away all my guilt. Kind of like how me imagining hitting Branley helped me take care of wanting to without actually doing it. Except in this case, it's not a good thing. Because that girl in Africa benefits in no way from you daydreaming about being her hero, Alex says. If my dad only considered giving us money instead of actually doing it, I'd be homeless and eating free lunch. And your mom would have to drink bottom shelf scotch, I add. Alex fake shudders. Good thing we're flush. Yeah, no shit. So did you send in $5? Alex asks. No. I asked Mom if we could, and she said that it was a stock photo that charity had been using since, like, the 80s, and she didn't entirely trust where the money went anyway. That sucks, Alex says. Yeah. The conversation dies, each of us drifting away. Alex's breathing evens out, and I know she's asleep, but I can't get there myself. Every time I close my eyes, I see that girl's cleft palate. I go ahead and pretend that I went to Africa and got her, that she came to live with me and we were like sisters. Even though if Mom's right, that girl is probably 20 years older than me, or even dead by now. But that's not going to help me sleep, so I pretend. I pretend that I make the world a better place.
Chapter 37. Jack. Newness wears off. This is something I've learned about relationships. I've had more than a few run their course, the idiosyncrasies that were once endearing becoming annoying, the jump of my heart into my throat at the sight of her lessening to a skip, then a pause, then the bare recognition that at some point slips into dread, and you know it's time to end it. It's different with Alex. The newness might have faded, which is inevitable, but it's grown into something better. The panic of not being able to come up with something to say to her has settled into the comfort of companionable silence, my hand resting on her knee or her head on my chest. The frantic need to be near her and know how she feels has morphed into an almost pleasant ache of missing her when she's not with me, because I know we'll be together again. We're happily entangled with each other in my basement, a basketball game on the TV that neither one of us is watching, an empty pizza box on the floor that I really need to grab before it's obvious we have a mouse problem. But I don't want to unravel my fingers from her hair or shift her off my chest. There are things I haven't talked to her about yet, though. Things I keep wanting to mention, but I'm afraid to ruin whatever moment we're in. I tug on her hair to make sure she's awake, fully aware it would be my luck to say something important to a girl who's fast asleep. She sits up, and I immediately miss the pressure and warmth of her against me. What? She asks, pulling her hair off her shoulders and into a ponytail. Do you remember when we met? I ask. It's an odd question to ask someone in a town this small. Chances are there was never a time we weren't in each other's lives, whether we knew it or not. We probably splashed each other in the kiddie area at the public pool while our soaking wet swim diapers sagged forever downward. We may have reached for each other from child seats in grocery carts as our mothers passed each other at the store. But I want to know if she remembers the night Anna was discovered, if she thinks of the version of me who participated in that, the guy with a fog in his brain and his pants around his ankles, a half-naked Branley underneath him. I want her to not remember, but I also want to rectify it if she does. Prove to her and to me that's not who I am. Being with her has killed that guy. Do you mean in the guidance office? She asks, and my heart lifts at least 3 feet out of my stomach. I could say no and come clean, but she looks so happy right now, and bringing up Anna can't possibly be the start to a good conversation. Yeah, I say. What about it? My mind is still in the woods that night, back when I was still a jackass and she still had normal posture, not always tense. Jack? She taps my leg. What about it? You said you weren't going to college. Why not? I blurt the first thing that comes to mind, my initial reaction to her statement months ago that I never got around to asking. Her face closes immediately, the tiniest shift of muscles making it obvious even in the dim basement that the conversation is over before it even begins. I'm just not, she says, the words even and measured. I sit up and our legs unfold from each other, the heat we'd made evaporating quickly in the cool, dark basement air. You've got the grades.
You're smart as hell, and it's not like tuition would be a problem.
Alex doesn't say anything, her eyes shifting to the ground. I nudge her leg with mine, trying to reclaim the easy communication we've shared before.
I don't understand.
It's not for you to understand. The first stab of annoyance comes fast and hard, painful because it's a mar on the perfection of our relationship. I never wanted to feel this way, not about Alex.
Try to explain, I say, my hand finding hers.
My life isn't like yours, she begins.
I know, I say too quickly. She closes her eyes, and I know she just felt that stab too.
Sorry, I say. Go on.
It's not like yours, she says again. You're supposed to move out among people, widen your horizons.
And you're not?
No, she says, shaking her head emphatically. It's better if I don't.
It's not better, I argue. What are you going to do? Get a job at the gas station? Waste your life flipping burgers?
Not better for me, she says quietly. It's better for others.
I'm about to tell her that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard when I remember the sound of skin tearing and Ray Parsons' blood on the church stones.
Her hand pulls away from mine, pointing at the empty pizza box. You've got mice.
They scatter as I jump to my feet, receding into the shadows. I grab the box and take it upstairs to the trash, Alex following me and pulling her coat on. We kiss at the door, the conversation unfinished but over.
I lie in bed pondering the wound that the first stab of our relationship left behind, wondering if it's one that can heal or if it will be fatal. I think about the conversation that might have happened if I'd had the balls to ask if she remembered the night they found Anna and if it would have gone better.
I text Alex and tell her goodnight. She responds with the same, and I hold my phone tightly, too aware that the present is all we have if I can't mention the past, and she won't talk about the future.
Chapter 38. Alex. I don't like to come home. Other houses have warmth in them, the lines between the people who live there humming with unspent energy ready to unreel. Conversations from the past still hover in the air, waiting for the threads to be picked up again. The air here is cold, empty to the point of sterility. When I hear my name, it's shocking, a word that isn't spoken, taboo. It came from the living room, so I follow it, the only light provided from the moon bouncing back off the snow outside. My mother is sitting on the couch, a cut crystal decanter on the coffee table in front of her, glass in her hand. Mom, I say, which doesn't sound right and never has. The word carries a history that we don't share, implies picnics and swing sets and trips to the pool. Who else? She asks, and I don't know what to say to that. Come here, she says. Have some scotch. I don't want scotch, and I don't want to drink with her. But it's the only olive branch she has to offer, so I take it, the alcohol heavy and hot as it rips down my throat. She throws hers back like water and pours another for both of us. You've been out a lot, she says. I have, and I don't like the guilt that seeps over me with her words, like maybe I shouldn't be. I have a boyfriend, I tell her. That word feels so meaningless here. Lacking the fullness it carries at Jack's house, the weight of his mom's hand on my shoulder as we stand side by side in the kitchen, pouring off-brand root beer into plastic cups. I take another drink of scotch, hoping it will make words come more easily. His name is Jack. Mom investigates the bottom of her glass, like she can't figure out how it became empty so quick. The boy who brought your car back? Yes. He's good-looking. I know he is, so I don't reply. She pours herself another and frowns a little when it overflows onto her fingers, flicking sticky amber drops off into the dark. Do I need to talk to you about... No, I say. We drink quietly in the dark, each swallow going down more easily than the one before. I feel it in a few minutes, my head floating, and the words I need to string together in order to get through this sliding off the surface of my suddenly slick brain.
"Do you have other friends?"
Mom asks eventually. "One," I say. I think about Sarah for a second, a person who I spend time with because we both spend time with Claire. "Maybe two."
"Gotta start somewhere,"
Mom says, her words beginning to slur. We're quiet again. This unfamiliarity of talking to each other, not comfortable, but not as painful as I thought it might be, either.
"You're so much like him," Mom says. "It's not easy for me, you know."
I don't say anything because I don't want to talk about this. Not about how my anger builds in my stomach and boils up into my head, venting out through my hands and mouth like steam escaping on the way. Not about how he was the same and I saw that once or twice. How he wanted to throw a punch or break her jaw, but he always stopped himself. And maybe that's something he could have taught me if he'd stayed.
"Once he was gone, I hoped the parts of you that are from me would have more room to breathe,"
Mom says.
"That didn't happen," I say.
"No,"
she nods. "I wish I could open you up, Alex. Unspool everything inside of you. And burn out the parts that are from him. Put you back together. And see my daughter instead of my husband every time I look at you."
I take another drink. If she doesn't instinctively understand that's the same thing, then I can't explain it.
"I've been trying to get him out of my life for 10 years,
she says, refilling her glass again.
"Little things build up when you live with someone. 6 months ago, I found a vase someone gave us as a wedding gift, and I took it outside and broke it. But I can't do that with you. A decade trying to get everything he touched out of this house, and I end up raising him instead."
My mom has poetry in her, something I never would have guessed. It must be where my words come from, flowing through me with a power equaled only by the fire in my gut. They're moving now, escaping in a way I didn't mean to or expect.
"I killed Comstock," I say.
"I know,"
she answers. And we drink a little more in the dark, that thread hanging in the air. And maybe one of us will reach for it again.
Chapter 39, PK. My dad has some crutch phrases. One of his big ones is, "This too shall pass." 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 17 and 18, if you're wondering. My mom always tacks her version onto that. "Time heals all wounds." Although I'm not sure she's placed her trust entirely on the earth continuing to rotate because she supplements with chamomile tea. So most of the crying done in my life has been over steamy mugs with herbs floating in them, the musty whiff of Dad's big-ass King James version flopped open across from me, while well-meaning pats on the back are supposed to make everything okay. This is how my trauma is handled. Everything from Grandma dying to my first kitten tangling with a speeding Jeep to getting my period. I did call Dad out on the "this too shall pass" thing on the last one. Then Mom got all loyal and explained menopause and the fact that technically Dad was right. It would just take about 40 years, and then I cried harder. So it's understandable that I didn't bring my broken heart to them, dumping the bloody pieces onto the dinner table after we finished our cherry cheesecake. They knew, though. They couldn't not notice that suddenly Adam was no longer a fixture in our house. A guy who was so welcome and trusted that he didn't have to knock anymore. But I guess maybe Mom and Dad are smart enough to realize that pointing out the second hand on the clock isn't going to suddenly mend the fissure straight through my aorta. Here's the thing, though. They were right. We're deep into winter, and I've stopped feeling like there is a spear in my chest every time he's up against Branley in the hallway. To her credit, I actually saw her push him away a couple times when I came around the corner. It's not like we're friends or anything. We'll give each other a nod in the hallway or cautiously say excuse me when we slide past each other in the senior cut line at lunch, but we're not coordinating our clothes every night. Still, the fact that she's trying to not throw it in my face set a warm glow in the black, gaping hole where I picture that spear passing through, so many times that the wound keeps getting bigger. Except, I think it closed up when I wasn't paying attention. The other night I got a text from a number I didn't recognize, an anonymous, "How are you?" I shot back, "Who is this?" A call came in from the same number 2 seconds later. I let it go to voicemail, listening immediately after I got the notification. And then, Adam's voice, definitely injured. "Seriously, you deleted my number?" I didn't add him as a contact, but I did keep the voicemail. The righteous indignation buried there amused me. I texted back. "Yeah, I did. What's up?" "You talking to Park?" Also amusing. "Yes, I am talking to Park, kind of. It started when he texted me to make sure I was okay after what happened at the church, an innocent, brotherly text that I didn't read anything into, responding that I was fine and thanks for checking. A couple of days later, he asked if I was coming to the basketball game, and I answered yes, and his response, a simple good, kind of set that glow I mentioned earlier into a spark. So we've been playing this careful game with each other, one that's fun to play because I know I can't get hurt too badly when all we're doing is texting sometimes. Once we went on an accidental double date when me and Alex and Park and Jack all ended up at the same diner one night. Except when I went to grab my bill, I realized that he'd already paid for my grilled cheese. When I said something, he smiled at me. So maybe it wasn't an accident that we met up after all. So when my ex-boyfriend asks, "You talking to Park?" I answer, "Yes." And our text conversation, out of nowhere, ends abruptly. And I couldn't give less of a shit.
Chapter 40. Jack. I kind of miss Branley. It's weird. In a lot of ways, Branley's my best friend, and suddenly cutting her out made that really clear to me. Yes, sometimes I'd have to plow through piles of shit to get down to the real Branley, the girl who used to sneak up on me in seventh grade and buckle my knee from behind. And it's work to bring that out of her, but it's worth it, always. And I miss that girl, even if she's buried inside of a tanned, waxed, lip-glossed, pouty Barbie doll who wants to fuck before starting a conversation. Because that's what would happen if I tried. I know because she keeps sending me nudes, each a little trashier than the one before since I never respond. She worked up to a video, and I watched it because, duh, and then I felt kind of terrible. If she just sent me a damn text with words instead of shots of her tits, I might actually answer her. But I can't, because she's a crowbar in a door I'm trying to shut, and she'll wedge her way in and use the leverage to get me in bed, and God damn it, I don't know if I could tell her no. I miss Branley, but I miss sex, too, and I'm trying to be a good guy, and why can't the two of those things be separate anyway? Tonight is not going to be easy. Park wants us to hang out at the church, even though it's ass cold outside. He's got this big idea that if Alex is there with me, then PK will be with him by default, but the downside is Adam somehow got in on this too, and that means Branley will be there. Park's fine with that because it'll just make it even more obvious that this is a couple's thing, and he's totally into PK. And I can't exactly explain to him that Branley sends me palm-worthy vids, and that makes the whole thing weird for me, because then he'd want to see it, and I'm definitely not doing that. I tried to communicate my non-interest in this group thing by just making throat noises when he talked to me about it, or responding with texts that just said meh, or whatever. But somehow Alex and I have become an integral part of getting him and PK together, and now there will be three couples there. Me and Alex, Adam and Branley, PK and Park. Read as, "The guy who used to bang Branley and his occasionally violent girlfriend who doesn't know Branley still sends nudes to him.
PK's ex-boyfriend, who she might not be over, and the girl who still sends nudes to the guy who used to bang her, and the girl who almost punched Branley in the face not that long ago, and a pretty clueless guy who thinks this is a good idea. It's a small town. There aren't a lot of dating options, but this is still its own special kind of mess. It's okay because I have my own ideas about how to handle tonight. The six of us all together can only be non-nuclear for so long, so Alex and I are going for a walk after about an hour. We'll be alone the way we both like it, and I have a surprise for her. And if I said that to Branley, she'd think it was my dick, even though it's like 5 degrees outside and I am human after all. Tonight I'm going to tell Alex that I love her. It's been like a pressure inside of me. A combination of words that wants to erupt at the wrong times. Sounds that might escape on their own if I'm not concentrating. I swear to God, I can feel I love you in my throat like a physical thing. And I need to make sure that when it finally gets out there, it happens in the right way. Because this is special. Because Alex is special. And I need to make tonight special, too. It doesn't start out great. Park is big on planning, but execution is another thing, and lighting a fire with nothing but soaked wood is not easy. "Son of a bitch," he says, as yet another match flares out before catching. Alex is watching him with her eyebrows crunched slightly together. I know she's trying not to embarrass him by taking over, but it's freaking cold, and our basic needs are going to overcome being polite really soon. PK has her hands jammed into her armpits and starts stomping her feet, which makes her boobs jiggle. Park doesn't even try to act like he's not staring, and Alex smoothly takes the matches from his hand while he's distracted. "Christ, it's cold," Branley says as she walks in, Adam trailing behind her. She's wearing the thinnest jacket possible. It hugs her tiny waist and accents the explosion of her boobs. She looks fantastic, but there's a reason she's freezing. "I brought body heat," Adam says, and Park makes a gagging noise onto Alex's shoulder. She knocks him onto his ass with her elbow as flames flick to life under her hands. "Good thing Alex got the fire started then," Branley says, clearly finding her boyfriend as lame as the rest of us do. Park drags a couple of bigger rocks over to the fire, and I help him with a pew, our combined muscles still not enough to get the damn thing off the ground, so we're making a horrible screech as oak that hasn't budged in years scratches its way across stone. It's accomplished eventually. We've got a fire that gives off heat, and seats and beer for everyone. PK claims a spot next to Park on the pew so fast that I know this entire thing didn't need to happen in the first place. But we're here now. Branley sits on one of the rocks, her cold hands jammed into her pockets so that the best thing Adam can do is take a rock next to her and put his arm in the crook of her elbow. They look like an awkward prom photo, and it's pretty clear if there's dancing, she'll be the one taking the lead. It's kind of funny. And my eyes meet Bran's, and she somehow finds a way to shrug with one eyebrow, and I'm trying not to laugh because secret communication across a fire with a girl who sends you nudes is probably not cool when your girlfriend is right next to you. Except Alex is not right next to me. She decided to sit on the ground for some reason, which leaves me sitting on an old aluminum lawn chair that someone dragged here in the 90s and never reclaimed. We're still close. She's by my knee, and she does rest her temple against my kneecap for just a second after I sit, which is nice and all, but I like seeing her face, and now I don't get to. I settle for running a strand of her hair through my fingers as I crack open a beer. The fire is hot, and the beer is cold enough to have ice chips floating in it, and I'm settling into a comforting haze when PK's phone goes off. She jumps, and nobody can miss her face collapsing when she reads her text. "Sorry," PK says, disentangling herself from Park. She's dialing as she walks away from us, her silhouette lost in the shadows. But her words float in the darkness, and the ones her voice cracks on might as well be said to our faces, they're so loud. "What? I thought he was... your parents?" okay? About you? Of a bitch. The cops? Don't think. Fucking terrible. So sorry.
Nothing good is happening here, and the rest of us are all looking at one another, not polite enough to pretend we can't hear it, and too curious to talk over her so that we actually don't.
PK comes back to us, flopping down next to Park, but not leaning into him, and he looks like a puppy that was told he was being adopted, but then someone changed their mind.
It's dead quiet, and he looks at me because he has no idea what to say or do. And then Branley saves him by being a pushy bitch because that's what she's good at.
What was that about?
I expect PK to tell her to fuck off, but there are three empty beer cans at her feet, and the fire's light only extends so far, making it seem like our faces are the only ones in the world. So instead, PK looks up from her phone, dark and silent now in her hands, and says,
"You guys know about Sarah's uncle, right?"
And we do, so it's not like PK really has to say anything else.
"You can't mow your yard here without someone knowing when you started and how long it took. So if you like kiddie porn, we will know. We will know, and it won't be talked about openly, but whispered behind hands, texted from one mom to the next. Autocorrect not picking up on the words we don't use often because they're too horrible. Kids will be kept a little closer when we're in the same grocery store, and smiles will be stretched tighter or dropped entirely. But we will know. And you'll know we know. Except Alex doesn't, because she's just now crawling out of that black hole of a house to become a part of us. So when Branley says, 'Sarah has a little sister, doesn't she?' and PK just starts crying, and Park says, 'Motherfucker,' like he means it, Alex doesn't know what to do. She looks back at me, so very lost, and I don't want to be the one to fill her in, but someone has to. So I grab her hand and we take the walk I've been planning, the heat from the fire leaking out of our bodies the second we leave the light, her fingers in mine as cold as naked bones. It's been snowing a little, so my tracks from earlier are filled in, and this could be the most romantic thing I've ever done, except it's not going to be, because I don't think I can very well follow up a conversation that has the word molester in it with my first declaration of love. But the dew is frozen, and the moon is so bright it looks like the entire woods is made out of shadows covered in diamonds. So maybe I can salvage this thing after all, and I'm trying to reset my brain when Alex says, 'What's that?' She breaks away from me, her feet punching through the snow. 'Hold up,' I call, wanting to be there with her, but she's ahead of me, so when I catch up, she's in the little clearing, a solitary Scotch pine standing sentinel in the middle. 'I found it last week after work, when Dad told me Mom said it's time for a tree to go up, only we can't afford the $20 to go buy one at a lot, so I thought if I could sneak one out of the woods without getting arrested for trespassing, that would be all right. And I found this one, the right size, no gaping holes, like it's auditioning for the role of Christmas tree. So I went to the car and I got my axe, but when I came back, I couldn't do it. There had been a light snow that day and the branches held on to millions of tiny flakes, flakes that would be dislodged by the first swing of my axe, then destroyed under my muddy boots as I tore into the trunk. The steel bite ripping through a life lived longer than my own just to die in the living room and be hauled to the street on December 26th. I couldn't do it, but I also know it's my last Christmas at home, and that's why Mom is insisting on a tree even though everyone knows there won't be many presents under it. So I stayed out until 2 in the morning and drove to the lot and stole a tree, creeping away with my lights off and the weirdest feeling in my heart. Because what I'd just done was technically wrong, but it felt more right than cutting down the pine in the clearing, and the tree strapped to my car was going to die anyway, so I might as well take it. And I lay in bed all that night and thought about trees. Dumbest thing in the world. And I wasn't sure what was keeping me up until I realized it wasn't my mom's face, crying, she's that way about holidays, I kept seeing in my head, but Alex's, and how she told me once she hadn't had a tree since their dad left. And that's when the whole thing came together. The woods, the words, I love you, waiting to be said, and all the things I can't give her because I'm poor and she's